I went to a minister's retreat this week at the Rolling Ridge Center in North Andover. It was supposed to be a two-day retreat, and I could only make it for one day, but it was worth the trip north to connect with colleagues, especially those like me who are in relatively new relationships with the congregations they serve. So we all agreed that for all the good learning and the new energy that abound in year one, we're also really looking forward to year two. There are so many new people and things that need to be understood and observed or paid attention to, and so many firsts, like Christmas Eve, for example, this year. An unnamed congregant came into my office and said, "It's really, 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 really important that that service is excellent." Okay. Okay, I got it. Keep my fingers crossed. So I approached this week's service, by the way, with some trepidation because I heard way back when the search committee and I were gathering that this is an important tradition here, this sap rising communion. People enjoy it. They look forward to it. It's an annual event. And I thought, this is wonderful. The little bit tricky part of it for me was the terminology. At least as I heard it called, the sap rising communion. And I asked Andy to share the sap with the children on their own this morning and saved our sap sharing for the end so that we could talk about that word just a little bit. I have to be honest. I have struggled with the word communion for a long time. I don't know if any of you may have as well. Coming from the Episcopal tradition, our prayers were quite clear about the imagery of communion practice. We were sharing the symbolic body and blood of Christ who suffered and died for our sins. Episcopalians, at least the ones I grew up with, don't generally believe in the transubstantiation of the wine and host, so it remains a symbolic form, although profoundly mysterious. Even if one does not believe in the transformation of the wine and the host into the body and blood of Christ, the ritual can be enormously important and powerful, and for many, very affirming. But still, communion and the words that go with it can be kind of tough stuff for little people. As a child, I was always in the choir. So I think for a long time, the words and their intention kind of swept over me. They were yet another part of the liturgical chant of the service that was both lovely and comforting in its familiarity, but also unattended to and not really quite heard at that age. My little friends and I were making sure we were on the right page in the hymnal or in the prayer book and that we had our music ready for the next song. And then at some point, as I got older, I heard the words and I thought, wait, what? You know that moment when you hear, when you really hear something for the first time, something you've been listening to for a long time, but suddenly it gives you pause. Which is a good thing, really. Whatever side you come out on with those words, it's important to know what it is you're saying and what those words might mean for you and for the others around you. No doubt, as I mentioned, and for those of you who are familiar with some of the liturgy, it mentions Christ's suffering. No doubt he suffered. But I remember thinking as I got older that there might be other ways for me to remember him than symbolically drinking his blood and eating his body, other ways than identifying him as a sacrificial lamb dying for my sins. I struggled with that. I want to be clear, ritual is powerful and amazing. It's not always comfortable. Sometimes ritual is intended for comfort. It's also meant, I think, to challenge us. whether a simple ritual like lighting a candle, or a more complicated form like communion, or Buddhist sashin, or daily Islamic prayer. There are elements of practice that invite us into a different kind of time, a different kind of experience. They're reminders of a connection to what we might think of as holy, perhaps. And often they're intended to connect us to those who practice the way we do. In the early days of this communion practice, way back when, a couple thousand years ago, I like to imagine a simpler ritual, perhaps. Maybe with the associated and prayers and creeds that are now a part of the service itself, not quite formed yet. Maybe early on it was simply a shared meal, with one loaf broken and one cup shared, a reminder of the people to whom they belonged, or of the lessons they'd learned, and of the ways they'd chosen to live with and among each other. Remember last week's story about the travelers on the road to Emmaus whose eyes were opened when the bread was blessed? Undoubtedly, at the beginning, communion would have been simpler and perhaps a little lighter. A dinner at someone's home, perhaps. Remember him, remember what we learned. But then history moves forward and things get complicated and people in positions of authority start imposing more elaborate rules, more defined procedures, so that down the line, only the priests could accept communion. And they faced away from the people and they spoke only in Latin. And it was their forgiveness that was sought in lieu of a direct relationship with the holy. And then things changed again, and local vernaculars were used, and the priests turned around, and eventually the gathered were included in the practice. Much of our early Unitarian religious freedom stems from these changes that were once considered quite bold. It became a community event again. But the part about Christ's sacrifice as a forgiveness of our sins, for our sins, that who knows when was added, is still intact. And this is where that theology and this communion that we share today have the opportunity to be different. If communion carries the weight of traditional Christian assumptions for you, or if it's the other extreme and it carries very little weight at all, then today I invite you to consider a simple ritual of sharing and covenant. Robbie Walsh's words that Greg shared with us this morning remind us of our relationship with the earth. We are deeply connected to the fruitful earth, he says, and we are called to its service. Acknowledgement of this interdependent relationship is one of our principles. Respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. Our relationship with the earth is not one of dominance, but of interdependence, of shared living. And we must accept the fact that these days we have not been good stewards of this relationship in many ways. We have not taken the time to appreciate the roses on the cliff, but have busied ourselves with our misperceptions of need, and so we have used and abused our planet for our own benefit. Today we have an opportunity to forgive ourselves for this behavior and to pledge anew to do better. Today we can remember that nothing on this planet died for us, but because of us, and we must begin anew. Sharing the gifts of the maple tree in the form of the rising sap gives us a chance to recommit ourselves to the service of correcting or at least ameliorating our mistakes. It gives us a chance to remember by tasting the juice of the tree, mingling its very cellular essence with our own, that our lives are woven, intertwined, tangibly and physically. This sap communion is a kind of promise and a covenant, a gift offered a gift received, and a gift offered in return, a cycle of shared existence. Let us practice this communion with intention this morning, with reverence and gratitude for the gifts of the earth, with forgiveness for our shortcomings, and the promise of work to heal our broken covenant as we commit again to respond. As we share our sap this morning, Yukiko will offer us the gift of music. We'll form a line up the center aisle, have some sap, and follow down back on the side aisles. And at the end, we'll sing together our closing hymn number 163, For the Earth Forever Turning.